Well, today I want to talk about radiometric dating. The geologist says this is the way that he determines the age of things. He says that this is the way he obtains these huge ages of billions of years. Well, even though he says that, that's not quite true, because from the beginning, when the fossil record was claimed to represent, you know, an evolutionary process, the results of an evolutionary process, he was claiming very, very great ages in those days. From the beginning, the geologist was assigning ages to the various rocks and the various fossils contained in those rocks. He used the fossils to date the rocks, and the rocks in turn to date the fossils, of course, following a pattern of circular reasoning. He assumed the thing that he said he was going to prove. If a structure, a fossilized structure, was very simple in organization and form, or body, he said it was very old. That, of course, is an assumption, because you can't just flatly say that's very old unless you have some way of judging that it is very old, you know, some criterion that establishes that age. And just a glance at a rock, just looking at a rock, does not establish its age. There's no way to look at a rock and just say its age is such and such. You remember one of the astronauts on one of those late moonwalks. He said he was walking around on the surface of the moon there, and he saw some rock at a distance. He got terribly excited, you remember. He said over there he saw a rock that's 3.5 billion years old. Well, that's amazing that he could do that. That's a wonderful ability. I wish I possessed that. It's a wonderful ability to be able to do that sort of thing. Well, of course, really what he meant was that the geologist back in Houston had told him to look for rock at such and such locality on the surface of the moon, such and such appearance, and that rock was 3.5 billion years old. He thought he saw it. By the way, it turned out later on that that wasn't the 3.5 billion year old rock that they were looking for at all, but he thought it was, and he got terribly excited that he had found rock, you know, that was supposed to have been in existence from the beginning of the moon. But some people seem to have that ability to be able to do that, to talk about rock being such and such age. Arthur Holmes, in his book, Principles of Physical Geology, he said this in the chapter on radioactivity of the rocks. He said, heretofore, geologists were like historians who knew that the Norman invasion of England occurred before the Battle of Waterloo, but didn't know the interval of time, you see, between the invasion and the Battle of Waterloo. They could just say that the Norman invasion occurred before the Battle of Waterloo. He said they could talk about this geological event occurring before that geological event, but couldn't make any statement as to exactly when that geological event had actually occurred. But he says now, with the discovery of radioactivity, the geologist is able to assign absolute ages to the occurrences of the various geological events that have been recorded in the rocks. And he says, today, no longer do we have to worry about whether we're approximately right or not. We can pin these things down very, very well and very carefully. Now, that was a wonderful confession that Arthur Holmes made. He was a bit belated, because if you go back to the old geology textbooks, oh, since the middle 1800s, they were assigning ages to those things. All you have to do is look at that geologic column in the picture, you know, right beside the page that starts the discussion of whether evolution is true or not, and there were ages assigned to them. They sure weren't talking about relative things, relative ages. They had the ages assigned to that. And you recall, as I remarked in an earlier lecture, the geologist that Kelvin had the encounter with in a series of letters had claimed that the Earth was infinitely old. And there was old Strata Smith, who way back in the early 1800s were saying that it took millions and millions of years to form a very thin layer of rock. And of course you hear all these popular statements, you know, it takes so many millions of years for an inch of limestone or something like that. The geologists still say things like that, and they were saying those things before the discovery of radioactivity, and those wonderful cliches that they love to throw around like that, they've still clung to them. And they've been talking about the age of things from the beginning, since the days of Lyell, who, you know, popularized the uniformitarian position and got it on its way. So what Holmes said is wonderful and good. in a sense, but really what Holmes could have said, now that the radioactivity has been discovered, the geologist can put some window dressing on what he'd been talking about before. It's not a matter of really establishing all that, it just gives some respectability to the whole approach. Because in the long run, radioactive methods are not really used to establish those times. Only when radioactive dates give values that fit the ideas of the paleontologist or the historical geologist on the age of those fossils are they really accepted. For instance, Scheidegger, Adrian Scheidegger, a geophysicist at the time he wrote the book Principles of Geodynamics, second edition, at that time he was at the University of Toronto, he made this remark. He said, in picking a radiometric clock, an element that will serve as a radiometric clock, he said, we must pick a mineral, such as uranium or thorium or potassium or rubidium. He said, we must pick a mineral that has a half-life that is approximately equal to the age of the Earth. By half-life, you know, is the interval of time that it takes a given amount of that substance to decrease by one-half that initial amount, the beginning of that half-life, into some daughter element. So he said, we must pick a radioactive element that has a half-life that is approximately equal to the age of the Earth. Well, if that's the case, then, if that's the way you're working this thing, then you're not using the radiometric clocks to give you the age of the Earth, because you've already decided what the age of the Earth is, isn't that right? If you must pick your clock according to the age of the Earth, then this, one would presume, means that you already know the age of the Earth. Else, how do you know how to pick the clock with the proper half-life? I don't know why in the world Scheidegger didn't notice that himself when he made that remark, since he's beating the drum like everything for radiometric dating. Well, just to give you another example, Scheidegger also remarked that when Cambrian rock is dated using the uranium decay process to lead as a clock, and he worked on Precambrian rocks. You know, you've heard of the Precambrian and the Cambrian. Precambrian supposedly before the Cambrian, and the Cambrian is about 750 million years old, 500 million to 750 million years old, according to their scheme of things. And he said this, that about half the time the Precambrian came out younger than the Cambrian, you know, using the radiometric clocks, uranium decaying into lead. Well, that's a fine kettle of fish, isn't it? A Precambrian, half the time, turning out younger than the Cambrian. Well, if you say that strictly I'm going to use the radioactive elements, the radioactive minerals, to establish the age of things, what do you do in that case, then? Because you see, there are a lot of places where you have Precambrian rock and no Cambrian rock. So it's not a matter of saying, well, I know the Precambrian comes before the Cambrian there, because there's no Cambrian present in the first place there. And it's just Precambrian, like upon the Canadian Shield. But anyhow, half the time it's that way. And on the moon, when they dated the first rocks there, by the decay of uranium into lead, they got values going all the way from just several thousand years to 28 billion years. Don't you just love things like that? That's always fun to see these fellows have a little bit of fun that way, trying to figure out what to do in a case like that. Yeah, all the way from just several thousand. Well, of course, you know what happened. They dropped off all those thousand-year ones, but they had some working on the other end to do. They had to drop off that 28 billion, too, because, you see, 28 billion gave the age of the moon larger than the age of the universe by the evolutionary scheme of things, because the maximum age of the universe is 20 billion years on that Big Bang hypothesis, not any older than 20 billion. And here you've got moon rocks turning out to be 28 billion years old. So that gave some trouble on both ends of that scale. So, of course, what they did was they just dropped off the two extreme edges and took the values in the middle. They hit right around 4.5 to 5.5 billion years. Why did they do that? What gave anybody a right to do that? Since we're using, you know, those independent radioactive rocks to establish our time scale. Well, of course, the thing that gave them the right in their view was that the 28 billion couldn't be right because the Earth is only 4.5 billion years old by the radiometric time clocks. And certainly those just those thousands of years could not be right, because again, the radiometric time clocks would say that is impossible. And they were so sure of their 4.5 billion years that they dropped off, you know, those extreme values. I heard a man from the University of Pennsylvania at a symposium at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, make the remark. He's from the geochronology laboratory there. He made this remark. He said, in carbon-14 dating and in uranium, thorium, lead dating, he says, when an age comes out differing somewhat from the established scheme on the basis of the fossils, he says we always just drop those dates and consider them to be in error. In other words, in the long run, it is still what? The theoretical views regarding the fossils that establish any ages. Because if your radiometric ages are too much at variance, they will be adjusted and changed to fit the scheme, you know, from the fossils themselves. I think it was Preston Cloud. He appeared at a Sigma Xi meeting on the University of Texas at El Paso campus, and he made the statement there. Preston Cloud's one of these high priests in the Uniformitarian School of Geology. Preston Cloud made the remark that he didn't trust any of those radiometric dates. He just went with the fossils. And I think, by and large, that is the view of most geologists. And the radiometric dates are just dragged in as what? Something to lend respectability to this whole thing when they are fitting the scheme of things. Otherwise, these geologists couldn't care less, most of them, what those radiometric dates are saying if they're not fitting right. Drop things off and consider that some laboratory technician made a bad measurement somewhere, or the waters were flowing on the side of the mountain and some uranium got washed out, or some lead got washed in, or some lead got washed out, or something, or some uranium oxidized with oxygen or something like that, and just dismiss the whole thing when it's not working right. When it's working good, you know, or fitting the values that you've already obtained, keep the dates. Well, what I'm getting at is this. Supposedly, the radiometric dates are independent, but they're not in any way at all. The fossils are ultimately the authority in all matters. And when I say the fossils, not because anybody knows the age of those fossils directly, but the ideas that the theoretical evolutionists have regarding the fossils represent the ultimate authority in dating any of these things, for that matter. What I'd like to do first is tell you some of the assumptions that are involved in the use of radioactive elements to get the ages of things, and then proceed on as we can to take a look at all of this from there. Now, let me first mention what a radioactive element is, and I'm defining these things rather loosely. If you really want to pin this down more or better, pick up an elementary book that describes radioactive elements and go into the physics a little bit yourself if you really want to. But a radioactive element is believed to be one that's unstable in its nucleus, and because of that instability in the nucleus, you have particles and energy released or emitted by the nucleus. Sometimes you have particles and energy absorbed by radioactive emitters or elements, but ordinarily the nuclei, the atoms of these radioactive elements, such as uranium or thorium or rubidium or potassium or carbon-14, they emit particles and energy, and in doing that the nuclei are changed, and consequently those elements become different elements through these processes. Some of these processes being very short, others of these processes being very long. And the element may go through many daughter elements before it finally ends up in a final state or a final stage. Now, in the early days, the principle is this. A radioactive element is very much like an hourglass. You know, in an hourglass, you have sand in the upper chamber, and you know how fast sand, you know, sifts down into the lower chamber through that narrow neck in the hourglass. All you need to do to get the time, if you want to time some event, turn the hourglass upside down, let the sand start sifting through there, and after a while look at how much sand you've got in the bottom chamber and divide that amount of sand by the rate at which the sand sifts through there. See, it always means you've got to have some kind of clock. In the long run, you've got to have the thing calibrated so you know how much a quantity, how much time a quantity of sand represents. Always there's something you've got to go by here. Nothing ever works out easy. And you can measure then the length of time that had elapsed since you turned that hourglass upside down. Well, suppose the uranium decaying into lead, you can measure the rate at which uranium decays into lead, you can measure the amount of lead that you have in a rock, then you can divide that amount of lead by the rate at which the uranium decays into lead, and you have the length of time that has elapsed since that uranium was emitting alpha particles and changing into lead. And that's the very simple and naive way of doing it. And Boltwood at Yale University in 1908 established the first radiometric dates by doing it exactly that way. Now, I agree the equations are much more sophisticated today than that little old simple formula. And that's a very simple one, but it's one that will get you the approximate answer that you're going to get by the more sophisticated equations anyway, for that matter. But roughly, that's how it works. Now, today, there's a lot more sophisticated equations using natural logarithms and things like that. to get the time that has elapsed, but roughly the formulas will give the same answer fairly closely. Bolt would assume that none of the lead in the rock was there to start with, that it was all produced by radiometric or radioactive decay, and that he could take every bit of that lead and put it as a decay product. And he got a very large value for those rocks that he dated from wherever he had taken them. This was the first determination. Now today, things are a bit more complicated and certainly much more sophisticated than they were in those early times. The equation today has these quantities involved in it. The lead that's in the rock now, see, if you go out to some mountainside and you find a rock that's associated with some geological event and it has uranium in it and has some lead, well, what you attempt to measure then is the amount of lead that's in the rock now. You try to measure the amount of uranium, say, that is in the rock right now. You know, when you dig that sample out of the side of the cliff or out of the stratum or wherever it may be, you measure the amount of lead that's in the rock, you measure the amount of uranium that is in the rock, and in the laboratory, supposedly, you get the rate at which uranium decays into lead. And you build an equation that goes something roughly like this. Lead now equals lead then. You see, the lead that was in the rock when it formed, plus uranium now times something like e to the minus kt power minus 1, where the k has to do with the rate of decay of the uranium into lead, and the t represents the time. You don't have to remember now on this test. I'm not expecting to put down any equations. Don't worry about things like that. I'm just trying to tell you what ingredients are involved in the calculation. I'm not expecting you to remember these formulas. If you're really interested in the formulas, you can read that monograph that I wrote on this, in which I worked out all these equations anyway, there, if you're really interested in the physics of the problem. I'm just trying to tell you what is involved in this, what you have to be able to measure. Now, there's no, I say no difficulty, it's a bad job, but relatively speaking, there's no difficulty in measuring the amount of uranium that's in the rock now. And there's not too much trouble measuring the amount of lead that's in the rock now. And there's not too much trouble getting the decay constant, so-called decay constant, you see, that's in the rock, that's for uranium or thorium or potassium or rubidium or whatever, or carbon-14, whatever the case may be. But you see, the unknowns in there, in that equation, are what? The lead that was in the rock then, that's one unknown. And what is the other unknown? The time. See, that's the thing you're wanting to find out. How much time has elapsed since the rock crystallized and the lead was formed in that rock by radioactive decay of the element? So you see, the thing that that you're wanting to find is the time, but there is another unknown in the equation. It'd be wonderful if you had one equation and just one unknown. Then you could solve it uniquely and get an answer. But instead, you've got two unknowns. You've got the time, the thing you're wanting to know, and you've got the lead that was formed, you see, in the rock to start with. That is an unknown also. How do you get rid of that unknown? So you've got one equation, two unknowns. You remember from your mathematics, you're not getting anywhere. You've got two unknowns in one equation, unless you can dream up another equation somewhere and solve the two together simultaneously and get the two solutions. So you see, you're off to a bad start in this. See, there's always this trouble when you have to work in the past where you have no direct observations. There's always an ambiguity and a weakness and an unclearness to things, and you must extrapolate and assume things rather than being able to pin it down. But to quote that astrophysics professor I mentioned last night, that's the name of the game. If you say you want to work on the past, then all right. You're saddled with a certain number of unknowns always that you must deal with. This is why when you're working with the present, it's so much easier to deal with, and you can find things out rather easily. When you have to work regarding the past, it's a very difficult job. All right, that's one of the difficulties. Now, you know, I mentioned, and I'll come back to that in just a minute or two, I mentioned also that you have in that equation that decay constant, K, or lambda, or anything you want to call it, whatever name you want to pen on it. Rose is a rose, regardless of the name. But that decay constant, I said constant, is it really a constant? That book that I mentioned earlier in my lectures, The Earth, you know, that had a whole slew of authors, and one of them, principal author, was Verhoeven. They have a chapter on radiometric dating, and they say, after billions and billions of years, can decay constants really be constants? Are they the same as they were when, you know, back at the start of things? Is a decay constant really a constant? And this is very important, isn't it? because if that decay constant, quotation marks, is not really a constant, then your clock may be running fast, or it may be running slow, or who knows what it's doing, or it might be running perfectly for that matter, but who knows what it is actually doing. And if the radiometric clocks, these radioactive elements, are the best clocks, as these people claim, they claim they're clocks. There's some doubt, and I'll be talking about this more, whether they're really clocks or not. But anyhow, for the moment, assuming that they are clocks, can be used as clocks, if they're the best clocks you've got, how do you check them to see if they're running fast or running slow? Can you use a Timex to check an Accutron by? Or if you can, I want my money back. From Boulevard. I'm going to go back to Dittmore Jewelers and get my money back if you can use a Timex to check an Accutron by it. Can you check an AccuQuartz by a Timex? You know, you've got all these digital watches. And good grief, they sell them for all the way from $30 to who knows what. But anybody now can have accurate time. It's open to everybody to be able to catch a satellite out there in orbit without a bit of trouble. I don't know why in the world a person wants an Accutron. I was silly to buy mine. Who in the world needs one? You know, something that's good to 2 seconds a month. Who's going to catch a satellite except for a few astronauts, you know? You might have a joining up with one of these things somewhere, but most ordinary mortals never need time that accurate anyway. If you got one of these quartz watches, they claim they're, what, a minute a year or something like that? Not a minute a month, but a minute a year. They're accurate to that. Well, I don't know why in the world anybody would need time like that, that accurately. But anyhow, how do you check one of those things? When I first bought the Accutron, my Accutron, I bought it from the only jeweler in town who had one of these little gadgets to check these things, you know, to see if they were running right. You can't put it on one. You know, a jeweler has one of these, I don't know what you call the gadget, where you set the watch on there and let it tick a bit, and it makes a line, either a curved line or a straight line on a piece of paper, and he gets that up and looks at it and says, all right, curves this way, it's running fast. If the line curves the other way, it's running slow. If it's straight, he says it's perfect. And right on it, why are you in here bothering me about checking your watch and resetting your watch? But you can't use just one of those ordinary gadgets like that on an Accutron. You have to have one that's built specially for that. Because otherwise the curve doesn't mean one thing unless it is good enough to really check that little vibration of the tuning fork, you know, very, very accurately. Well, there were just in El Paso, there were only about one or two jewelers that had any of those gadgets. And I went out to San Diego one summer and couldn't find a jeweler anywhere to check my Accutron, see how it was doing, because they hadn't even bought those things, you know, to check them by. And of course, for a final check, you have to have a WWV signal from the Bureau of Standards. You know, you have to pick up that Naval Observatory signal. They used to go by the stars. Today they go by what? Atomic clocks themselves. They used to go by the rotation of the Earth, looking at a star on a meridian. And today they don't even bother with that. They've got an atomic clock, too, that sits ticking around. They put a signal on the air, depending on how their atomic clock is doing. What I'm getting at is this. How do you ever decide whether your clock is running right? You can't just use an ordinary clock to check a good one by, can you? Otherwise, I remember a friend of mine telling me they had a very accurate timekeeping device at one of the laboratories in Oak Ridge. And they had a janitor who used to go in there and sweep. And he thought he had a good watch. And he was always checking for those. He wasn't supposed to be monkeying with the timing devices in this laboratory, but he always, out of curiosity, checked the clock they were using, you know, this very fancy one for keeping time in one of their experiments, with his watch. And he would reset it. Turned out he was resetting it every day. It didn't match with his watch. He thought that, and he didn't tell anybody about that he was resetting it. And the people, you know, who built the clock, they were puzzled. This thing was not, nothing was working right. This thing was not keeping the kind of time it was guaranteed to keep. And the Oak Ridge people at the Oak Ridge National Laboratories there were having to get the builders of this timekeeping device in continually trying to find out what was wrong with that clock, why it wasn't keeping time. And it just happened one day that this janitor was there when they were around working. He asked them what they were doing. They said they're trying to find out why in the world the thing wasn't keeping time. Right. He said, well, it is a terrible clock. But I have to reset it every day. Well, that's a true story. And so, of course, then their worries were over once they found out what was actually happening. Well, these people, of course, they want some kind of way of checking these atomic clocks to see if they're really running right. Well, I'm going to give you the scheme that was suggested originally for deciding whether an atomic clock was running fast or running slow. and then we'll see what it is actually doing. Now, there is a very famous law in nuclear physics called the Geiger-Nuttall law. The Geiger-Nuttall law. This is a law that relates the decay rate to the radii of what is called a pleochroic halo. Now, pleochroic is spelled P-L-E-O-C-H-R-O-I-C. It's a tongue twister. I'm getting the syllables out right. Pleochroic halos. I'll probably mispronounce it a half a dozen times before I'm through. But anyhow, a pleochroic halo is formed in this manner. A uranium atom emits alpha particles. An alpha particle is about the size of a helium nucleus. These little alpha particles come out of the nuclei of the uranium atomic emitters, the atoms. And when the particle comes out of there, there are eight of them, they come out at a certain energy level. Each particle has a different energy level from another particle. And the particle will travel until kinetic energy that the particle possesses as it comes out of the nucleus is dissipated in overcoming the resistance of the rock. And when the particle stops, you have a discoloration and a destruction of the lattice structure of the rock. And you have a little halo form you see around the atomic emitter, because this atomic emitter emits particles, you know, in all different directions as it continues to throw out these little alpha particles. So you get a set of rings or halos about the emitter called pleochroic halos. The pleochroic halos have a certain radius. Each of them has a different radius from the others. And the radius, as I say, depends on the energy level of the alpha particle as it leaves the nucleus of the atom. And if the decay rate remains constant, according to the Geiger-Nuttall law, the radii of those halos should be constant also if the atomic emitters are in the same kinds of rock. For instance, if it's located in a certain type of rock, and some other time, you know, that's supposed to be very, very different in age, you've got the same kind of rock, you've got the same kind of uranium, uranium-235, or something like that, or uranium, one of the other isotopes, uranium-237, and so forth, any of them that you want to pick, you should have the halos with the same radii as they were in the rock, say, that were of a very different age. So the agreement was this. The Geiger-Nuttall law says that the radii of the pleochroic halos and the decay rates are related through a logarithmic function. And so if the decay rates have remained constant, then the radii of the pleochroic halos should be constant too. If you always look at the same kind of rock, so far as the physical composition is concerned, even though the rocks may be of very different ages, you should have halos that are the same in radii. Now, this was the agreement. This was way back in the early days when they first started to look at this to see if they could make a decision about those decay rates, whether they stay constant with time or not. Now, this is the way to check the clock in this case. It's believed that Geiger-Nuttall law relates those quantities. There's a lot of question today, though, about things, and I'll mention more about this later on. All right? Everybody then proceeded to try to find out whether the halos were constant in radii or not. There was the Irish geophysicist, Joe Lee, who was probably one of the earliest investigators in this matter. There was an American geophysicist by the name of Henderson. There were quite a number of people, all the way Marker Holmes, Alfred Knopf, and others, who were interested in this problem, making a decision about it. Millikan, R.A. Millikan, at the University of Chicago, had said there was no way to change the decay rates. But people were still uncertain. He said there was no way in the laboratory you could change those decay rates. He made that statement way a long time ago, and people still print it in their textbooks, although things have changed radically since the days of Millikan. But anyhow, everybody began looking at these halos then. And some years later, after much investigation in this whole regard, Joly published his results. And he found that the halos had varied all the way from a few microns up to as much as 35 microns. Micron is very small, but these halos are very small. And that much change is a very, very large change in those halos. So Joly said, well, the halos are changing. He took rocks of all different ages where he could find pleochroic halos, and he found that there definitely was a change in the radii of those pleochroic halos. Henderson found the same thing, and so a big meeting was called in which all of these fellows talked all this over, because things looked kind of bad. Well, Alfred Knopf got up and made the remark. He said, yes, obviously the halos have changed in radii. But, he said, we can explain those changes in the radii of the pleochroic halos on an entirely different basis than that of a variation in the decay rates with time. And the only troublesome thing about Knopf's statement was he never ever got around to telling what those reasons were or that other basis was for explaining the variation in the radii of the pleochroic halos, which was unfortunate since everybody waited with bated breath and so forth for that startling announcement as to what could be causing the variation in the radii of those pleochroic halos. To this day, nobody's ever said what could cause that if it were not the changes in the decay rates. Well, of course, who wants to go back to the drawing board on the goose that lays the golden eggs, you know? It's given those big, large values of millions and millions of years and so forth. Now, you say scientists don't work that way. Well, you judge for yourself in regard to the matter. You can make up your own mind. If everybody makes flat statements of the decay rates, their constancy will be determined regarding the constancy of the radii of the pleochroic halos, and then you have a very famous investigator, and Jolie was a very famous one, who finds a variation in those radii, and then everybody turns around and says, oh no, we can explain it on a very different basis, but never says what that basis is. Well, I think that's a bit tricky, to say the least, in regard to the matter. Well, Henderson found a variation. Now, in more recent times, a man by the name of Roy Allen in Delaware, a metallurgist, he repeated Jolie's work. He found that Jolie was exactly right. There was a large variation. In very recent times, there's a man by the name of Robert Gentry, who's with the Oak Ridge Laboratory, Oak Ridge National Laboratories in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and he's done far more work than anybody, put all of it together, anybody has done, and he says there's a tremendous variation in the radii of these pleochroic halos. Now, the people, you know, I mentioned Verhoeven and that gang who wrote the book The Earth, and they said, can the decay rates be constant after all these billions of years? And then in the next sentence, Verhoeven and company said, yes, the decay rates are constant. Time doesn't make any difference. The pleochroic halos have remained constant in their radii, and consequently we can say that the decay rates are constants and have not changed at all. As beyond me how Verhoeven and company can neglect completely the work of Jolie, the work of Henderson, later on the work of Allen, and of course in recent times the work of Gentry, which shows that those halos have varied in their radii. Well, that's the state of it, so far as the agreement was concerned. It would seem to me that we would have to say the decay rates have changed if the Geiger-Nadal law is correct. And nuclear physicists believe that it is correct. Now, one can always say, oh, that's the thing that's wrong, it's the Geiger-Nadal law. Well, here you've got something that is fairly well established, the Geiger-Nadal law. It has that word law on it, and physicists don't use that word law too easily. It means they've played around with it and tried everything on it that they can think of, and it keeps coming out right the way the thing is saying, and then they pin that word law on it. They don't like to use that word law very loosely. It would seem to me that here you have a law, the Geiger-Nadal law, which is saying the decay rates are not constants. But yet the geology people are saying, yes, the decay rates are constant. They're saying our radiometric dates match the fossils. But I don't hardly believe that's the case. The fossils were decided, and ages are tossed out when they don't fit, and you have Cinderella's ugly stepsister's Bigfoot forced into Cinderella's shoe, you know, to make it fit. And that's not exactly right to do it that way, I don't think. Well, one other thing I want to mention about this. As I told you, Millikan said that there was nothing you could do in the laboratory to a radioactive element to make the decay rate change. You could step on it. You could squeeze it. He didn't say step on it. I'm teasing you a little bit. You could put it under high temperatures. You could heat it up until it nearly vaporized. You could put all sorts of large and small magnetic and electrical fields around it. You could do all sorts of things to it, and Millikan said there wasn't any way you could change those decay rates. And after that, everybody believed it, and nobody really tried too much until they got a lot better instrumentation toward the end of World War II, and then they began to take a second look at this whole problem. Some physicists and chemists began to take a second look at it. I remember lecturing some few years ago at West Valley College in San Francisco, and Dr. Lanphier, who's written a book on potassium-argon dating, was lecturing opposite me. They had four lecturers there, and two of them opposing two, you know, giving opposing lectures. Dr. Lanphier represented the establishment viewpoint that things are very, very old, and I represented the other viewpoint that things are quite young. Somebody in the audience asked Dr. Lanphier, and this was in 1974, asked Dr. Lanphier, has there ever been any change produced in a decay rate in the laboratory? Has anybody ever done it? Dr. Lanphier, who is an authority and an expert on radiometric dating, said, no, it has never been done, period. And he said, that's enough to say about it. It has not been done. Well, that's a very shocking statement, to say the least, when that very same year, Emory, in the Annual Reviews of Nuclear Physics, published a paper, which was a survey paper of what had been done since 1949 up to 1974 in attempts to change the decay constants of radioactive elements. Emory pointed out that 14 different radionuclides had had their decay rates changed in the laboratory. 14 different radionuclides had had their decay rates changed. Not just one or two, not just scraping something up out of the barrel here and there with a very slight change, but 14 different ones had had their decay rates changed. And it was common knowledge, and the papers had been published, you know, in the standard journals regarding this. And he cited in this paper, he went through the various experimental approaches for doing it, cited all of the papers that had been published regarding it, gave the experimental results, and summarized what had been done between 1949 and 1974 in attempts to change the decay rates of radioactive elements. And it had been done for 14 different ones. It had been done by using magnetic fields, electric fields, and by the way, extremes of temperature. Millikan just didn't have the equipment for doing a lot of this, measuring some of these changes that had taken place. It had been done by varying the rates at which stresses are exerted on rocks, and he found, or these different investigators had found, that you could change the decay rates quite a great deal, as a matter of fact, all the way from a tenth of a percent. One change was 4%, and if I remember correctly, up to as much as 12 to 14% the decay rate. So it is possible to do it in the laboratory, and if it is possible to do it in the laboratory, then it is certainly possible to do, one would think, it would be possible to do under natural conditions where you have much larger amounts of energy available and where you have radically different conditions so far as stresses that can be exerted. Well, it can be done in the laboratory. And these statements that you read in textbook that there is no way to change the decay rate, that's pure foolish talk. It's not correct at all. It has been done. The papers are published. All one has to do is just look in the journals, you see, that have to do with these things. The decay rate of carbon-14 has been changed. A fellow by the name of Anderson, a chemist of Chattanooga, Tennessee, has done it. These works have been published. All of this is common knowledge. I thought it was a rather surprising statement that Dr. Lanphier made. Here is a man who is an authority along these lines, but yet he is denying that this has ever been done, when it is not something that is hidden in a closet, but is something that is readily known and available in the standard publication, not in the Creation Research Society quarterlies, not one published there. All of these things are in the standard journals, such as Annual Reviews of Nuclear Science and so forth. So it is common knowledge that this can be done. Now really, right there is enough to say you don't have a radiometric clock, because if the decay rates change, can be changed, have the possibility of being changed, then there's no way you can use those things as clocks unless you know how to correct them. And who knows how to correct those things? One other thing I should remark about that. Today, a very different view of the atom is being put forth. When I was a student, everybody said that the changes in the nucleus were spontaneous. You know, that the thing just suddenly, out came a particle. The particle squirted out of it very suddenly, and nobody knew what caused it particularly, how it came, some energy too. And they said these changes were spontaneous, having nothing to do with outside effects. A very, very different view now is being taken of the atom. It's believed today that the whole atom is involved in this decay business, that the electrons, the shells of electrons that exist around the nuclei, have a great deal to do with this decay business. It's believed that particles such as neutrinos and neutrons and whatnot affect these decay rates rather radically. Today it's believed by many physicists that instead of that thing being a decay constant, it's just a stability index and can be changed very readily, as the astrophysicists would say, by our swimming around in a neutrino sea in this universe. And so a whole new view is being taken today of the nature of radioactive decay. And if this continues and experimental evidence is accumulated, you may see some very radical changes in this whole picture in just a few years, as a matter of fact. Finally, some physicists are beginning to think for themselves and quit believing everything the geologists say, you know, about ages and whatnot, and you're beginning to see some real experimental work and some independent thinking. Some of these physicists have finally decided to lay aside Millikan's book published back there around 1919 or 1920 and start taking a fresh look at some of this to see if really he was right. And it turns out that Millikan was not right. Millikan was a great physicist, and I'm not denying that for a minute. But in those days, they did not have the technical development of the instrumentation that you have today for measuring small quantities. It has changed radically. And regardless of Millikan's stature, it has been done in the laboratory by reputable investigators. So there's no question about it. It's been done. And that's that. It's been done. It's been done. So it doesn't make any difference who said it couldn't be done. It's been done. The experimental evidence is there. But as I say, I think you're in line for seeing quite a number of changes in the viewpoint of this whole thing as time goes on. And that old question, could the decay rates have remained constant over these years? I think the answer is no. I don't think they're constants in the first place. And I personally think this new view of the atom is certainly more in line with the evidence that instead of that K being a decay constant, it is a stability index of the atoms. Everything is unstable, for that matter, by the way. Believe it or not, everything is a little bit unstable. Some things more stable than other things. Neutrons are unstable. They decay. But some neutrons, if they're fairly stable, and others are not stable. So you may see some changes taking place in this whole view of things as time goes on. So, as the old soap operas would say, can a young woman from the mining camps of West Virginia find happiness with the title of Lord from England? Well, the answer is no. In this case, can the decay rates be constant over a long period of time? The answer is no, I think. And really, that would be enough to settle it right there, but I have more to say about it. Let's go back to that other thing that I talked about. Now, I'm skipping quite a great deal on all of this and just picking out a few high points to talk about. Let's take a look at getting that lead then in the rocks. You know, I mentioned that just a little while ago, that you had to be able to decide how much lead was in the rocks to start with, you know, to put in your equation there, or else you have an unknown remaining in your equation. How do you ever decide in the equation how much lead was there to start with? You know, you have various schemes that have been suggested of nucleosynthesis of elements in the crust. There are different views. Some people believe that elements formed in the earth itself. Others believe the elements came from the explosion of a star, you know, and the whole thing just came together. Nobody has the slightest idea how elements could form on a naturalistic basis, you understand. And I certainly haven't the slightest idea how they could form, period. As you know, I believe they were created, and I don't see how they could have formed on a naturalistic basis in any way. By the way, when Gamow, with the Big Bang hypothesis, was trying to figure out how he could get all those elements, he could never get past helium, you know, and trying to work out how you convert this radiation into matter. He was never able to get past helium, theoretically, on this. But that didn't bother anybody too much. Just keep right on going anyway and say it happened somewhere or other, and because obviously the elements are here, so it must have happened, even whether you can explain it or not. But anyhow, here you just have to make a guess on that amount of lead in the rocks then, because there's no way to decide it. If you could decide that immediately, what would be the use of fooling with all this, you know, and trying to get an age worked out, because you'd already know everything you needed anyhow. Now I'm talking this way because we'll pass up my objection for the moment that the decay rates are not constant, and we'll just give them the benefit of the doubt. Of course, you understand, I don't mean that seriously, but let's go on to take a look at another aspect of the problem. Now, the way you, as I said, you just make an educated guess on that lead in the rocks then. That's the only thing you can do, is just make an educated guess. And how do you make an educated guess?
Well, it depends on your education.
And by your education, I mean your philosophy that you hold regarding things. That's what I mean by saying it depends on your education. If you are a strict uniformitarian, you will what? Pick that lead then so it will be large enough to give you the ages that the fossil, the people working with the fossils, say you should get. Now, if you don't believe that, suit yourself. But you can decide yourself how you'd get it if you want to. There are about 7 different models for trying to decide on the amount of that lead in the rocks then. The 2 most famous are the Holmes-Hooterman model and the Alpher-Hermann model. The Holmes-Hooterman model being the one probably followed by most geophysicists working in geochronology. The Holmes-Hooterman model says the concentration of uranium and lead that you find in chondrite meteorites represents the concentrations that were in the rocks of the Earth in its initial state, you know, when these clocks began to tick away. And these men say all you need to do is pick up these chondrites and measure the ratios of the leads and uranium isotopes that you have in those rocks, and you can establish the concentrations that should have been in the Earth when these clocks started to tick away. See, they believe that chondrite meteorites are from the breakup of a planet, a hypothetical planet, I'll put it that way, that existed out between Mars and Jupiter, you know, broke up for some reason or other, some kind of an explosion or collision or something, and formed the asteroid belt. And they maintain that these chondrite meteorites come from that planet that existed out there, and they believe further that that planet was like the Earth, you know, in its early stages on the evolutionary scheme of things. Well, that's a big lot of ifs, to say the least. First, if there were a planet there, see, that's an if that nobody can pin down or prove. I don't know of any way to prove it. If you ever come up with one, let me know. I'd be very interested in it. And he proved there was a planet there. Listen, the thing's broken up in pieces. Kind of hard to get old Humpty Dumpty back together again, especially if you've got millions, billions of these meteorites and decided that there was a planet out there. It's a bit tricky, putting a big puzzle together. So you're off to a bad start if it existed out there to prove it. If there were a planet there, how does that guarantee that the interior of that planet is like the interior of the Earth? You know, like the rocks here on the Earth. Mars, it is believed, is very different from the Earth, except not too different in size and maybe mass, but it's believed to be very different on its interior. Jupiter, I don't think you find anybody think Jupiter is even remotely like anything, you know, one of the terrestrial planets. It's a Jovian, what's called a Jovian planet, and certainly radically different from the terrestrial planets. So what guarantee would there be, even if these chondrites do represent the fragments, you see, from an exploded planet or a colliding planet or something or the other, what guarantee is there that this represents something that is similar to what was in the Earth in its past? And then furthermore, there's a paper by a man by the name of Arden, and he had a colleague. They are both British physicists. I've forgotten the colleague's name, but the paper was published in Nature back in 1971, in which these people showed that you had far too small a amount of uranium to account for the amount of lead that is in those meteorites. And they said there's something very badly wrong here. We've either gained a lot of lead or we've lost a lot of uranium, one or the other. And these people went on to remark that all of these radiometric dating methods involving the decay of uranium into lead and the 2 decay processes that use that, they said these are very seriously then in question. They are very doubtful because the initial concentrations for the uranium and lead that these people are using to put in those equations based on these chondritic meteorites are obviously badly in error, and so the whole thing is wrong. And these men ended the paper by saying this casts in serious doubt radiometric dating. Now, this was coming from 2 fellows who were not creationists, but they said this casts in serious doubt radiometric dating using uranium lead clocks, the dating of things on the Earth. Because in the Holmes-Hooterman model, they were getting their initial concentration of lead from studying those meteorites. Well, these meteorites travel through space where there are no protective atmospheres, and you have neutron bombardment, you have cosmic radiation, cosmic ray bombardment. It is well known by the nuclear physicist that this sort of bombardment of elements with high-speed particles can radically change the concentrations by transmuting those elements into other elements. This has been done on the moon, and the NASA people acknowledge that this is taking place,
And by the way, they believe that's one reason they came out with such a range of ages, you know, there, that this was happening and throwing everything off. Well, how in the world, then, if it's happening on the moon, can you with any real certainty trust what you're getting, you see, from meteorites that have certainly traveled through space where there is no protection, and who knows how long they've been traveling in orbit, you see, about the sun, before we intersected those orbits and they impacted with the Earth. How can one, you see, make a decision then on the amount of lead that was in the rocks then? It is purely what? An educated guess. It has nothing to do with the scientific procedure. How would you like it if somebody gave you a set of answers, but they said they had to guess completely without any real knowledge of anything on part of one of the variables, you know, that was in the equation they used for getting the answer? Now here you have, you see, methods that depend on a certain quantity being a constant, yet the evidence is that it is not a constant, but yet it is treated as a constant. And then another factor in that equation depends on your being able to guess right as to what, you see, the amount of lead was to start with in the rock, without any knowledge whatsoever of how much was there, but to just guess at it, and the guess being conditioned already, you see, by the view that you have regarding the age of things. Listen, that has nothing to do with science, you see, really. That's as unscientific and as non-scientific as one could just about dream of, I think. That has no resemblance to correct scientific procedure in any way. So, to sum up then, the decay constants do not appear to be constants. There are assumptions that have nothing to do necessarily with reality. Purely guesses made on the basis of presuppositions about the age of things. This is what your radiometric dating is based on. And certainly respectable scientists should not follow such a procedure as that. Okay. All right. Commercial's over. Break, station break there. All right. Now I've got more to say here on this whole thing. I want to go back to all of this a little bit. Let's go back to that guessing business. I have much more to say. I don't like this guessing. And then presenting as if you knew exactly what you were talking about. That bothers me a little bit, at least. The Alfred Herman model, some people use it, not very many people use it. It's the Holmes-Sudermann model that is really being used today. As I told you, that paper that was published cast serious doubt on that. You remember when at Apollo 13 it was, you remember it got into trouble about halfway to the moon? And something was happening. I've forgotten now what it was that was happening there. But anyhow, it looked rather badly for a bit that those fellows would get back. They certainly looked like tried to go on to the moon, there'd be no coming back. They tried to go on, even if they could make it. And then you remember the NASA people decided just to have them try to turn around and come back, and that was what was done. Suppose, now here we have this radiometric dating that is supposed to be a very, very valid approach to things. It has a constant that's not a constant in it. It has in the equation. By the way, you have to change the equation radically if your constant's not really a constant. So that old equation that I cited doesn't even work anymore if it's not a constant, you see. You have to get a brand new equation. You have to truck a new one out to work. If it's not a constant, that changes the whole picture very radically in regard to the matter. Then you have your constant is not a constant. You have to guess about it, but yet you're saying when you publish these things, we have established very, very accurately the ages of these things. How would the astronauts in that Apollo 13, how do you think they would have felt? I'm sure they're probably, well, I say I'm sure, I don't know whether they're scared or not. I'd have been scared. I'd have been out there in Apollo 13 and things were going badly and it looked like we were stuck for a little while at least, not going anywhere. I would have surely been scared, but I don't know whether they were or not. But anyhow, I don't think they would have been so confident if the people at Houston Control had said, fellas, we got a few laws here, we're going to try. We got Newton's law of gravity, you know. We got Newton's three laws of motion. We have to guess a lot about these things, and they've never been proved. As a matter of fact, one of them's been disproved. But you can't lose all the time. You've got to win a few now and then. We've got to win sometime. So we're going to try to figure out a new orbit for you and get you back, you know, on that basis. So don't worry. We'll get you here. We'll be having supper with you after a little bit here, and Home Sweet Home and Terra Firma and The Pearl of the Skies will be yours once again in just a few days here. These laws, as I say, we've never proved any of them. And they never really worked on anything. But don't worry. We've got the greatest confidence in these. We know what we're doing. We know what we're talking about. So hang on. Well, I'm sure those fellows would have figured, forget about it. We won't be back. Just don't hold supper for us. We won't be joining you. But here the geologists are saying, we have this works, although I pointed out, and it's common knowledge, and I've not pointed out something that's hidden from view, you know, and something one or two or three or four people have dreamed up. It's something that is common knowledge. But yet they keep saying, this proves so-and-so. This establishes the age of the geologic column. This establishes the ages of those fossils, and so forth. This is the sort of thing, the level of the scientific reliability of this radiometric dating business. Now, let me make some comments. I'm going to have to use this lecture time right up to the end. This is my last lecture for you. And I need the time. I've got more to say about this. What I don't get said, you can read in that monograph. But I told you what I would ask you. Now, I've said enough already for that test, what I would want you to put down on that test. So don't worry. This last half hour is tying up, there's so many loose ends I've left on this, just tying up a loose end or two here and there. There's one other thing that I want to look at about these clocks. See if they're really clocks. There are different kinds of schemes you can build or equations that you can build involving these lead isotopes. You know, there are three lead isotopes, lead 206, 207, and 208. Lead 208 comes from the decay of thorium-232. The other two isotopes of lead come from decay of isotopes of uranium. You can make combinations of the leads, just measuring the amount of lead that you have, and get times out of that if you believe the scheme of things. This fellow Melvin Cook, you know, I mentioned his book. He made, I think, probably the most important study that's been made of the uranium-thorium-lead clocks, and I urge you very strongly to read his papers. He published two of them, if I remember correctly, in the Quarterly of the Creation Research Society. Cook recognizes, everybody recognizes, and even the evolutionists recognize that you're guessing, you know, on that initial quantity of lead. And so Cook wanted to build an equation to get rid of that initial amount of lead. This equation that he would build would not tell him anything about the actual length of time that had elapsed, but it would get rid of having to know what that initial quantity of lead was. But it wouldn't tell the age, but it would give what is called an age index, or a time factor. It would be a quantity that wouldn't tell you exactly the age, but would tell you whether something is very old, or whether it is very young, or whether it is in between in this whole scheme of things. So he built an equation. Some people call it a time factor, an age factor. Others call it a time index or an age index. Now, this is an equation that was not original with Cook. You find it in a number of books on nuclear physics applied to geology, particularly to radiometric dating. But Cook was the one who really pushed it and used it to see what it would tell him. Now, you see you have lead 206 and lead 207. Lead 206 coming from uranium-238, and lead 207 coming from uranium-235. The two isotopes of uranium decay at different rates, so that one lead, you see, is produced faster than another lead as time goes by. Now, Cook built a ratio involving these two isotopes of lead. And this ratio involved differences. And as I say, if you really want the formulas, you can look them up. I translated Cook for you to read. If you try to read his papers, they're horrible. He skips 10 steps going from one equation to another. And I'm one of those physicists. I have to, you know, see where the equation comes from, or it leaves me feeling uneasy. And so in that monograph that I wrote, I discussed Cook's work. It is a critique, you see, of radiometric dating. So I discussed Cook's work, which I consider probably, well, in my opinion, the most important that's been done in recent years on this. And I translated some of this there. You will find it here. I'm just hastening through it, and I'm not explaining it very well at all. But he built a ratio involving these two kinds of leads that are produced at different rates for the two isotopes of uranium. In building this ratio, he got rid of, by having a difference in the numerator and a difference in the denominator, he got rid of having to know the initial concentrations. The way it worked out, that's subtracted out of the equation. Now, he doesn't get the times, you understand, the actual times that have elapsed since the clocks began ticking away, but he has something that should change as time goes by. Now you see, if you start out with a certain amount of lead 206, and a certain amount of lead 208 to begin with, or lead 207, 206 and 207 in your rocks, assume that the evolutionist is right, assume that the Holmes-Hudeman model is right, assume that the Alpha-Hermann model is right, take this time factor or age index equation and see if it leads to a contradiction or something that is illogical. This is Cook's approach. See, he's assuming the evolutionist is right. Well, this is a valid approach. Assume that he's right, that it is a clock, and that what they said about the initial concentrations were correct, and just use those in there. Use the model, you see the two models, and see what kind of a result you get. Now, he has built a ratio here, you see, which will change with time. In other words, the ratio of lead 206 to 207, if they're produced at different rates, will change as time goes by. Just like in a race, where the people, you know, are able to run at different rates. Well, right at the start of the line, at the starting line, everybody comes out and they're about even right there at first, aren't they? Unless somebody really zooms out right fast. But anyhow, they usually don't do that. So you've got a bunch that are right there fairly close to each other. But as time goes on, what happens? The racers begin to separate, don't they? And the fellow who's faster ordinarily begins to, at least if he runs without thinking about it, if he's just running, the fellow who's faster starts getting way ahead, or getting ahead at least some. So after a while, if the race has been going on for a long time, you'll have a bunch that are way out in front of what? The others. But if the race has been going on for only a short period of time, everybody will be about the same, you know, right back there at the starting line. Or to use the apple picking example, you've got two baskets here, and you've got a picker that's pulling apples off on one tree, and another picker standing over here who pulls apples off a tree at a much faster rate. Well, right when they start, there's not much difference in the quantity of apples in the two baskets, isn't that right? But if you let them pick there for an hour, the fellow that's a lot faster, he'll have what? Many, many more apples than the fellow over here who is picking rather slowly, relatively speaking. Lead 206 and 207 are produced at different rates. And consequently, as time goes by, the ratio should vary radically, shouldn't it? Ratio should vary rather radically. So here's what Cook did. He took the Holmes-Hudeman model, he took the Alpha-Hermann model, he calculated what those that age index would be for rocks of all alleged different ages. And you see, if the rocks are very old, the ratio of the two leads should be such and such value. If the rocks are very young, then the ratio should be a radically different value, because this age index has been changing as time changes, because the ratio is continually changing. One kind of lead is being produced faster than another kind of lead, so the ratio of those two leads in the rock should continually change as time changes. All right, here's what Cook found. He said, now, if what you people are saying is right, these things really are clocks, then when I take a whole set of samples of rocks of alleged different ages, then I should get age indices for those different rocks that are radically different according to the model. In other words, Cambrian rocks should have an age index of such and such value. Cretaceous rocks should have an age index of such and such value on the basis of the ratio of lead 206 to 207. Well, here's what he found. Instead of finding this large variation from very old rock to very young rock, he found that those age indices were practically the same for rocks of all alleged different ages. There was quite a range of values for Cambrian rock. There was quite a range of values for Cretaceous rock. There was quite a range of values for Carboniferous rock, and so forth. But the range of values was about the same for all of the rocks, you know, of alleged different ages, and the average value of that age index for all the rocks was practically the same. In other words, there was no sign of aging. In other words, there was no progression of values, you know, from something very old to something very young. You had an average value that was practically the same for rocks of all alleged different ages. So Cook concluded, and I think he's right, either those things are not clocks, they're not really working as clocks, and I think that's one answer that's certainly true, because the decay rates certainly seem to be varying, and they're not acting as a clock should act. And he said the other possibility is, maybe it is a clock, but the clocks have not what? Been ticking very long, so that you do not have any sign of what? Aging associated with all of this. Either way, these people are in trouble, either way it turns out, in that regard. One other thing I'll tell you about, I've got time maybe for one more squeeze in here before you're ready to go to lunch. I should say something about carbon-14. If I've got any time after carbon-14, I'll come back and say something else about uranium, thorium, lead, lead clocks. There's some very important things I should say, but time's gone nearly. Radiometric dating is not something you cover, you know, in just a few words. It's in a lot of universities, it's a course that can occupy two semesters. Just talking about all this, these people have built up a very elaborate scheme of things, and it takes some discussing to really discuss it thoroughly. Carbon-14 is very famous as a method for dating archaeological artifacts and happenings and the past history of the Earth, of society, cultures, and civilizations on the Earth. Geologists don't use carbon-14. They say it cannot go back far enough, you see, to be used to date geological events. Let me tell you how the carbon-14 method works, and then I'll make some comments on it. The Earth's atmosphere is being bombarded by cosmic radiation. Cosmic rays are just high-speed protons. Who knows where they come from? Probably from the sun, from other stars. But anyhow, just a flow of high-speed protons. They collide with particles in the upper atmosphere of the Earth, and neutrons are produced. Those neutrons collide with nitrogen atoms, nitrogen-14 atoms, and produce carbon-14 atoms. That carbon-14 is an unstable form of carbon-14 and will decay over a period of time, exponentially, back into nitrogen-14. So, if you've got an animal or a person or a plant that's breathing, taking in air, as carbon-14, you know, is formed in the air, it decays back into nitrogen-14, but it takes a while to reach an equilibrium state. You know, it builds up until finally you've got enough carbon-14 in the atmosphere that the rate of destruction of the carbon-14 is the same as the rate of production of it. But it takes a while before the rate of destruction will become equal to the rate of production of the carbon-14. The rate of destruction being caused by the decay, production being caused by the influx of cosmic radiation, and the production of neutrons, and the combination of those neutrons, the interaction of those neutrons with nitrogen-14 atoms. Well, it takes a while to build it up. Plants, animals, men, everything breathing air, they're breathing carbon-14. You get carbon-14 in your body, and if you're walking down an arroyo, say, and a flood comes down, you get drowned, well, the exchange with the atmosphere ceases, isn't that right? No more carbon-14 coming out, coming in, and the carbon-14 is being changed into nitrogen-14 because of this decay continually, you know, taking place in your body. The exchange ceases, you were buried under the gravel and sand and so forth. And some years later, an archaeologist walking along and sees your bone sticking out of the rocks there, out of the gravel there, and takes it into the laboratory, measures the amount of carbon-14 in it. And if you believe the conventional theory, if you can measure the carbon-14 in that specimen, now you can set that equal to the carbon-14 that was in the specimen when it got buried and the exchange, you know, ceased. I'm putting it simply. It's a bit more complicated than that, but anyhow, the formula is more complicated than what I'm saying. It's equal to the carbon-14 that was in there, you know, when the exchange ceased, times e to the minus kt power, is that e to the minus kt again. K has to do with the decay rate or the half-life. Or the carbon-14, t is the length of time that's elapsed since the specimen, the exchange with the atmosphere with carbon-14 ceased. All right, solve the equation, and out comes your answer. Well, there's a number of difficulties there. You have to know what? Carbon-14 that was in the specimen when the thing died. Well, that's hard to know. If you knew that, you wouldn't need to know anything else. You'd be all right. Well, of course, what these people do, they assume that the carbon-14 that was in the air then is the same as the carbon-14 that was in the air before they started testing atom bombs and hydrogen bombs, you know, changing the carbon-14 balance in the atmosphere rather radically. So they say back about, 1950, I think it was, they take it down to there and use the concentrations down to that time. Well, that's an assumption, of course. And with the decay of the magnetic field, you're going to radically change your concentration of carbon-14 in the atmosphere anyway. But they assume that. And consequently, they say they get ages for things. Now, supposedly, this thing goes back 50,000 years. You can't pay a bit of attention to a statement like that. There's not an instrument built that can measure activity of decay of carbon-14 atoms. Those things have been around 50,000 years. That activity, unless you've got something built out of solid carbon-14, something like that, you can't measure any activity like that. That's just naive statements. Don't pay a bit of attention. You see something 50,000 years, 30,000 years, you can't measure. There are no instruments that can measure that good. You can go back with this scheme 5,000, 6,000 years. That's about it. Well, anyhow, though, that's how you get the age for this scheme of things. Let me tell you what I think is a major objection to this scheme for dating things. You know, I remarked that carbon-14 had to build up quite a bit in the atmosphere before the rate of destruction would be equal to the rate of production of it. If the two are equal to each other, carbon-14 is said to be in an equilibrium state, if the two are equal to each other, or in a steady state. If the carbon-14 is still building up, in other words, it has not reached that state where the rate of production and the rate of destruction are the same, then it is in a non-steady state, or a non-equilibrium state. Now, when Libby got the Nobel Prize for his work with the carbon-14 method, which he devised, he assumed that carbon-14 was in a steady state in the atmosphere, even though the atmospheric physicists were saying then that it was not in a steady state. They said in those days, and that was back in the late 40s, that the carbon-14 was still building up about 12% faster than it was being destroyed through decay. But Libby could not believe that at all. And the reason he couldn't believe it was, the geologist said the Earth is billions of years old, and it takes for our atmosphere about 30,000 years to reach a steady state. It takes about 30,000 years for carbon-14 to reach a steady state in our atmosphere. So Libby said, well, that can't be, you people can't be right, because there have been many 30,000 year intervals that have elapsed since 4.5 billion years, so you must be wrong. So Libby went ahead, you know, with his method, published it, got the Nobel Prize, $19,000 worth out of it, and everything rocked along happily until fairly recent times. These atmospheric physicists kept working on this problem, and today they are claiming, and these are not creationists that are claiming this, men like Suess and Langenfalter and others, they're claiming that no, it is not in a steady state, that it is, there's about a 30% difference. Rather than it being 12%, they said that was bad measurements, that was too small. The difference is around 30 to 32% in the rate of production of it and the rate of destruction. They are claiming that it's still on the uphill side, is still building up, has not reached that equilibrium state. Now, if it has not reached the equilibrium state, then that equation that I told you about has no application whatsoever and must be amended and set up in an entirely different fashion. And what this means is all of those ages, going back roughly 5,000 years, you know, that they've done with those carbon-14, the carbon-14 technique, must be corrected for this imbalance or this non-steady state, this building up of carbon-14 in the atmosphere. And the larger the age, the larger the correction is. So carbon-14 is not reliable unless you make that correction. But carbon-14 has, the amount of it in the atmosphere, has a very significant point, though, associated with it that I want to mention. If it is still building up, it is possible to calculate the amount of carbon-14, the length of time to accumulate the amount of carbon-14 that you have in the atmosphere. Do you remember a problem like this? Perish the thought if you ever had to solve one like it, but you can make one up like this. This is roughly analogous, not quite the same. Suppose you have water pouring into the bathtub at a certain rate, but yet the bathtub has a leak in it. You know, nearly all of them do. Gradually the water goes out around the plug. The water goes out at a certain rate. Suppose you have so many gallons per minute coming in, so many gallons, hope you don't have a leak that bad, but so many gallons per minute going out. But the number of gallons per minute coming in is faster than the number of gallons per minute going out. And that means, of course, the water level continually rises, doesn't it, in the tub. Now, if the water were going out at the same rate that we're coming in, then the water level would stay the same in the tub, and there would be no way to calculate the length of time that it took to accumulate the number of gallons of water that you have in the tub. But if it's coming in faster than it's going out, you can calculate then the length of time it took to accumulate the number of gallons that you have, if it's still building up, you see. Last night I got to watching television and almost let the tub run over at the motel and ran in just as it was right at the, about to reach, really going to a non-steady state and pour over the sides. Ran in just in time. But anyhow, you can calculate the number of gallons that it takes to accumulate, it takes to accumulate the amount of carbon-14 on the same basis. If it's still building up, you can make that calculation. If you set up the differential equation, go through the mathematics to calculate it, taking a difference of about 30 to 32%, you get as an upper limit for the age of the atmosphere of the Earth that it is about 10 to 12,000 years. The atmosphere of the Earth, it would take only 10 to 12,000 years to accumulate the amount of carbon-14 that's present in the Earth, in the Earth's atmosphere at the present time. Now, I agree, this doesn't give the age of the solid part of the Earth, but it does give the age of the atmosphere. The Earth's atmosphere is made up mainly of nitrogen, so it's very easy to form carbon-14 in it. There's no difficulty of that nature, but it would seem to put an upper limit on the age of the Earth's atmosphere. Well, since plants and animals have to breathe, I presume at all times they always breathe, then the fossil remains of plants and animals that you have in the sedimentary layers, those plants and animals had to breathe, and they had to have an atmosphere then. And it would seem to me that puts an upper limit on the age of those fossil remains of being no more than 10 to 12,000 years old at the very most. And, of course, the plants and animals they represent couldn't be any older than that themselves. So it would seem to me that you, all these talks of millions of years could not remotely be correct. And when you take a look at the non-equilibrium state of carbon-14 in the Earth's atmosphere. I told my students down in my astronomy class, my freshman astronomy class, I was telling them about, you know, the breakup of comets and the influx of cosmic dust. And I had a student, I must tell you about this, I've just got a minute or two anyway, and it won't take much more than that to tell you about it, instead of going on to a new method, which would take me another 50 minutes. I wouldn't want to interfere with your lunch hour. I have a student who loved arguments among professors, and he heard me talking about the young age of the solar system, how these things were breaking up. Of course, it always puts these students in a state of shock until they get used to it. You know, that things might be young instead of old. They've been so brainwashed terribly in this regard. But anyhow, he was taking an anthropology class at the same time under a Dr. Moore across the campus of the museum. And he went over to Dr. Moore's class and he said, Professor Slusher said today that the solar system was no more than about 10,000 years old. And of course you can imagine what an anthropologist thought and had to say about that. And so Dr. Moore said, I want you to take a message back to Professor Slusher for me. I want you to ask him about this. Said, we anthropologists know that man is at least 1 million years old. And what was the state of things? Man here, no solar system. So this student came over and he said, Professor Slusher, he said this in class. I was glad he did. It was a lot of fun. He said, Dr. Moore wanted me to give you a message. He said, I told him that you had claimed that the solar system was about 10,000 years old, and he said to ask you, since an anthropologist knows that man is about 1 million years old at least, how man was getting along, no solar system, but him around. I said, well, all right, how about taking a message back to Dr. Moore? To me, then, you know that old song, take a letter to Lucille. I said, take a letter back to Lucille for me, then, on this matter. I said, taking a look at the non-steady state of carbon-14 in the atmosphere, you know, that's not in equilibrium, I want you to ask Dr. Moore for me, then, what man was breathing, then, if he came into existence 1 million years ago, and the atmosphere of the Earth is only 10,000 years at the most, what was this man breathing, then, that was around here that 1 million years ago, since he wouldn't have any air to breathe, no atmosphere 1 million years ago, what was he breathing? Well, the student really liked that. He said, say, give me the equations on that, too. So we fixed up a nice little letter to Lucille, or to Dr. Moore, back over there, and I gave him the equations and the calculations. He took it back over, and he said, I asked him later on. I never got a return reply. But I said, what did Dr. Moore have to say about my letter, or my message, the return mail? He said, well, I told him what you said, and he said, see me after class. And he said, I showed him those equations. He said he'd look them over and let me know. Well, alas, I never, ever heard from Dr. Moore again. He's still around. We both are. But we never corresponded any after that. I never heard from him.